Good afternoon. Welcome to the Center for New European Research at Hitotsubashi University. I'm Jonathan Lewis, and I'm here to discuss Takahiko Tanaka's paper, International Relations in the Formation of Cold War Structure, with the author, Takahiko himself. And also we're joined by Darius Zhifonen of the University of Konstanz, who's a visiting professor here at the Institute for research on global issues, study of global issues, at Hitotsubashi University. Okay, that's all the awkward institutional names out of the way. Takahiko, thank you for racing across campus to join us on a really hot, humid June, late May day. A lot of students here at Hitotsubashi were born in the mid or maybe even the second half of the 1980s and have really no memory of the Cold War. So for people who can't remember what it was like, what was the Cold War, simply?
Well, it is very difficult to talk about the Cold War very simply because it was a gigantic structural phenomena. Usually people tends to say that the Cold War was a kind of the confrontation between two blocs headed by two superpowers. And that could be the very simple picture. But you could see there are so many events within the blocs, and at the same time the superpowers were trying to make a sort of the cooperative behavior, and that could be seen as a kind of the political instruments to rule the world. I mean, a joint rule. So it could be argued that the Cold War was a kind of the global governance, because the Soviet Union and United States were trying to stabilize the world system. Because if the world system went to really destabilize the situations, they would have to expect this nuclear exchange would occur, and so they were trying to just stabilize the world system, but at the same time that kind of the joint and the ruling governance. Could be inviting the resistance from their allies, and that's why the two superpowers were trying to keep confrontation in a way in order to control the alliance. You see, allies.
I see.
So, and at the same time, they needed to control the allies in order to prevent those allies from going to their own war, sometimes sort of driven by the nationalism or
yes.
those kind of things. So that was a pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious that the Cold War had an aspect of the global governance.
Yes.
So that was a kind of the governance through the confrontation and stability through confrontation. That was a pretty paradoxical
yes.
thing. So. At any rate, I think that it should be pretty much noticed that the Cold War was a very complicated,
yes.
and a very and a structural or big construction of world politics.
I see. And the paper, International Relations in the Formation of Cold War Structure, has recently been published on the Center for New European Research website. You can download the whole text there. But I understand that you did not write the paper recently, but you actually wrote it a few years ago.
Yes. That was about 1998 or something like that. And after that, I altered, or should I say sophisticate? You know, I have rather tried to sophisticate it.
Yes.
In my paper, I just concentrated upon the relationship between the United States and Western Europe. Well, usually, as I talked, the Cold War was tended to be seen as a kind of the confrontation between two superpowers. And people tend to think that if you look at the United States or Soviet Union, you could understand the whole picture of the Cold War. But I think that we need to look at for example, the allies to the superpower. So I just put a focus upon the Western European response to the United States. And the U.S. response to the Western European allies, and so that was a kind of a starting point of my research, and from then on I have been trying to write about the whole picture of the Cold War. So, because I was looking at the relations between the U.S. and the Western European allies, I could reach it to the sort of a tentative conclusion that, as I told, the Cold War was a kind of a global governance.
Yes.
But at the same time, that global governance contained some strong resistance from the allies to the superpowers.
Yes.
And I haven't changed the idea, which I just wrote in my paper, that kind of a resistance inside could be one of the most important causes of the end of the Cold War, terminating the Cold War. So but this kind of the way of looking at the Cold War is pretty new nowadays, because so many historians in Britain and the United States started to try to look at the Cold War as a kind of a global history, including the relations between the allies and the superpowers, and at the same time they tried to dig down to the response of the public opinions.
Yes.
And transnational relations across the national border, at the same time the frontier of the two blocks, between the two blocks. So my paper was a kind of the precursor, if I may say, of the that kind of a new way of looking at the Cold War. And I am now very much interested in the more social aspects of the Cold War. I mean, citizens, for example, the Cold War consensus.
I see.
And cultural transformation, or the social transformation, and the Cold War, I mean the relations between them, and I have a sort of the pretty rough hypothesis that the social transformation, which had started much much long before the Cold War started, actually caused the end of the Cold War. For example, the end of the patriarchal society.
Yes.
Could make the governability very lower. And
sorry, when would you say that the patriarchal society ended or started to break down?
It traced a very long process.
Yes.
Some of the British historians say that that started in the 18th century.
I see.
Well, of course, regionally, the process should be variant, but most of the historians admit that in the middle of the 20th century, the most of the Western world or the advanced countries had the same kind of a phenomena of the erosion, the various serious erosion of the patriarchal society. And, the patriarchal society is a kind of the basis of the easy governing. I mean, the government, if government can control the daddies, and if daddies could control their family, the government could control the family very easily. But after the erosion of that kind of a society, the government started to find it very difficult to govern the society as well. I mean, well, we're related to the Cold War. The Cold War structure was so complicated, and at the same time, the Cold War structure should be governed very sophisticatedly, otherwise that would explode, and that is the explosion of the nuclear weapons. So, you know, global governance was, Cold War as a global governance was supported by that kind of society which could be controlled, which could be governed very easily. But if that kind of a society was gone, I think the ability to control the Cold War system, Cold War structure, should have been very much diminished. So that was a kind of that was one of the very important aspects of the end of the Cold War.
Yes. Darius, you're a sociologist as well as many, you wear other academic hats as well, but how do you react to Takahiko's points about the breakdown of the patriarchal structures in society as being partly responsible for the end of the Cold War, if I've understood the argument correctly?
Yeah. I think this is a very interesting argument, and I think we could try to develop it maybe together jointly a little further. I think what's implicated in your argument is that, in a certain sense, the Cold War helped to maintain this structure, even though it without the Cold War structure, it could have broken down much earlier even. Mm. So in a sense that the patriarchal society had been just... Around the time when the Cold War started, it might have been at a point where it could have been even less important than it stayed for another 40 years, due to the fact that the Cold War was such a encompassing oppressive structure, if you wish. I wonder if this would fit to your idea, or if you think that this is going into a different direction than what you're suggesting.
Takahiko's taking copious notes.
Oh, yes, of course. This is a very good occasion for studying. You know. Yes. Actually, it is very difficult to decide the when the kind of the social transformation became the strong enough to that erode the whole structure of the Cold War, this kind of big structure, and of course the time lags should be taken into account. I mean, in terms of the regions. Mm-hmm. So, and at the same time, the patriarchal erosion of the patriarchal society. Could be deterred in some way, or the effect of the that kind of social change could be deterred by the, for example, in the Soviet Union, when in the Eastern mm-hmm. Europe, and by strong and authoritative the government, governmental power. So, and I must say that if you try to find out some social or conditions which helped. To end the Cold War, you might be able to pick up that aspect. And I think we need to accumulate those kind of and the findings. And I must say that the Cold War could not be over right away, but it was eroded, gradually, and at the same time, at some point of perhaps the 1980-something, 1985 or 1986. So, those many factors and the many the symptoms of the change just gathered and then that exploded. But this kind of image I have got.
Well, I think that what might support your argument would be that at least in the in Western Europe, from the 1920s on, we see that women become a large factor of the labor force, and the family structure, in that sense, is eroding in many of the Western European countries. Another factor might be that because of the war and the war economy in the 1940s in the United States, women became all of a sudden also a large portion of the labor force, and the American economy, as in war, how often happens in war times, began to rely on women. So the social role of women at this point was probably much stronger than before the war. And only the Cold War and the change to a new post-war economic system helped to reinforce patriarchal structures of family and organization of economy and in a capitalist society, in such an economic society, the organization of economy is, of course, of crucial importance for the maintenance of the social structure.
Darius, you're from Germany, and when we were discussing this before Takahiko joined us, you commented on the portrayal of the role of Germany in the article, and I wonder if you could raise those points now, if you can remember.
Yes, I will try. If I read your paper correctly, I think what you're saying is that in the history of Europe, we have seen a strong fear of Germany for a very long time as being one of the dominant aspects of European politics, because of the German tendency to try to become a hegemonic power on the European continent and to play a power political role. And the concept of Mitteleuropa has been very dominant in the German political conscious. I guess what you're arguing is that this has in a way been replaced by a fear of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, whereas Germany has transformed itself into a civilian power. Now I'm wondering if we could, if this notion of a tamed power of Germany is might have to add something. I think that Helmut Kohl, after 1989, repeatedly stated that European integration and the German reunification were questions of war and peace. And I think we can interpret Kohl's statement that these are questions of war and peace in a way as an implicit threat that if Germany doesn't become doesn't get its share of power and its share of influence, it could then again turn itself from a civilian power into a power political player. So that there is still an underlying German threat or an underlying a power that could also be transformed again. I was wondering if you could see that, or if you.
I would certainly chime in with some of the British right's attitude to Germany in the 1980s, particularly.
That's a very interesting question. And we're talking about Germany during the Cold War. We need to talk about the European integration as well. And then there's so many countries around the Germany, especially France. Kept up being afraid of the possibility of the German resurgency as a unpredictable power, unpredictable nation like a Nazi Germany. And but I think the European integration was a kind of the peaceful instrument of the containing the possibility of the unpredictable Germany. And the West, well, of course, Germany was divided into two, and West Germany, led by Adenauer, was very much positive about the European integration and about joining into it. And so I think the German, the participation in the European integration changed the feelings and the kind of apprehension about the resurgence of the Nazi Germany held by the neighboring countries, because the European integration transformed the nature of the power from my viewpoint, drastically, because within the European integration, the Germany could not use the military power in order to exert any influence.
That's right.
And the German people, and of course the Western German people, they learned about it. And at the same time, unlike the Japanese, I should emphasize, the German people, and they studied a lot the lessons of the World War II. The mixture or the combination of those the conditions just to change Germany or the Western Germany itself, and of course at the end of the Cold War, the United Germany was to be absorbed into the European Union, European integration, and because of that kind of transformation of the power, nature of the power. Of course, Germany could be the kind of a center of power, but the meaning of the power is quite different. So I wouldn't think that Germany would go back to the power politics, military threatening politics. But Germany became Europe, and Europe became a kind of Germany. So this kind of a combination would, I think, make it actually nonsense to think about the resurgence of the power political Germany.
Okay. Turning back to the paper, you concentrate mostly on political aspects of the Cold War. One question that many readers might have is, where is the economy in all this? The Cold War is not only portrayed as a military or confrontation, but also as a confrontation between two systems of organizing economies, communism and capitalism.
Yes.
And certainly in many textbooks and other writings, it's the end of the Cold War is portrayed as the victory of capitalism over communism. Where is the economy, or what role do you give to the economy compared to, for example, the growing resistance of people in the West and in the East to the oppressive orders under which they had to live?
Well, that's a great challenge. The economy or economics is one of my great weak points. Well, yes, as Jonathan said, the Cold War was not only the struggles, the political struggles, but also the economic and perhaps the social struggles as well, because the Soviet Union or the West each bloc tried to display the superiority in the standard of livings and the better structure of the society, and so that was the total quasi war.
Yes.
You know, Cold War was.
I'm sure we all remember that film of, was it Kennedy and Khrushchev, with Kennedy showing the color television. And Khrushchev?
Yeah, that's a kitchen debate.
Yes.
That was between the Khrushchev and Nixon.
Nixon, who was
the vice president of the Eisenhower administration. And they just tried to boast about the modern kitchen. The Soviet kitchen was really vast because of those fridges were made just beside the tank was made.
They're probably still working today.
So they've got a very strong kettle, you know, and you can't destroy. Well, at any rate, so they were struggling against each other in terms of economics as well, you see, I was very much interested in the new interpretation of the Cold War history, and one of the novelty. If any, paper was that I could interpret the origin or the starting point of the Cold War as a kind of the starting point of the terminating process of the Cold War. So I rather concentrated upon the economic the effect of the economic relationship, for example, between the two blocks. See, those kind of the aspects. So I actually did not really try to depict the relationship between the capitalism and the communism or those kind of things, but I was very much interested in the European tradition, well, if I may say, tradition of the social democracy. And, you know, the Cold War started in Europe, of course, but the Cold War ended in Europe as well. And, well, social democracy, it could be a kind of, it could be located between the Americanism, American capitalism, and communism. And so I think the kind of the ideological distance could be much shorter between the Soviet Union and Western Europe than the between two superpowers. Well, this is very simplest, with rather oversimplified the image, but I have this kind of image. That's why, look at the Britain, for example, in 1948, the Foreign Minister Bevin really wanted to restart the trade. Yes. With, the, for example, Poland or the Eastern Europe. So you know, the economic structure or the economic networks which had existed before the Second World War was actually the basic structure for the survival of the Western Europe. But the war just severed all the networks, and then after that, well, it was very natural that those European, Western European countries tried to resume those kind of networks. And I would think, when I actually wrote, that the European, West European countries really wanted to
the mobile phone is currently being viewed and
again
put back in the pocket. Quite right, too.
So, you know, for the Western European countries, the natural economic situation was the existence of the entire European market. But because of the Cold War, the market was divided, of course, and narrowed. So in those situations, the European, Western European countries needed to use all economic resources within Western Europe, and so they needed to how can I say? They needed to promote the inner Western European trade.
Yes,
and that was, I think, one of the main reasons for the European integration, economic integration. So, and European integration, from my viewpoint, was actually paving the way for ending the Cold War. Well, I would like to jump to the ending point of the Cold War.
Yes.
I think the Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, was no one would deny he was the main protagonist of the ending of the Cold War. And reading his memoirs, you could see that the Gorbachev actually needed some alternative model of order in Europe after terminating the Soviet control over Eastern Europe. And of course, as you know, the Gorbachev really was not at all unwilling to end the Soviet control over the Eastern Indeed. Europe in 1986, 1987. So, and at the time, before he went to France in 1986, that was the place for a visit as a the head of the Soviet government. He just thought of the common home, a European common home, a European common house. So, you know, he was actually inspired by the French role or the French status as the heading or the driving force of the European integration. And the European integration could just prepare the very good, the basis for the new kinds of order within which the not really power politics would prevail. Rather, the Eastern Europe could be absorbed very smoothly into the expanded Europe, and perhaps he thought that the Soviet Union could get some benefits from that.
Yes.
So, if so, you know, European integration was actually activated or accelerated by the division of the market, and then the development of the Cold War. Well, I think they contributed very much to the ending of the Cold War.
Nodding over there. How do you see this idea that the European integration was one of the factors that enabled this opposition between communism and capitalism to break down?
I think that you're quite right when you portray Western European welfare state capitalism as being somewhere in the middle between American-style capitalism and socialism, and that European integration, Western European integration, might have served as a model or as a future perspective for the Soviet Union. At the same time, I'm wondering if this has only been become for Gorbachev an alternative or a perspective because the Soviet Union was basically bankrupt at that point and didn't have the power, probably the military power at that point, but not the economic power to sustain its dominance over Eastern Europe, and maybe not even to sustain the Communist Party to sustain its authority over the Soviet Union because of the very difficult economic situation within the Soviet Union.
Yes. Well, I agree that the Soviet Union failed to restructure their economy in the 1970s because of they got too much benefit from the oil shock.
Yes. Huh.
So that they actually did not really think of the possibility or the necessity to restructure their economy, and that was one of the reasons for their economic failure, and their economic failure was one of the most important factors to end the Cold War, and that was actually sort of a common sense, and there are lots of people tend to say that, and that's why people tend to say that the Soviet Union lost in the Cold War, but. I rather tried to find out another different aspects. Mm. I mean, the economic transactions between the two blocks, or economic process, the change in the political situation caused by the economic process. We need to pay much more attention to that. And if you look at the relationship between the United States and the Western countries, I mean the developed countries, you can see the relationship of interdependence deepened so much, and the political influence of the United States getting down and down and down in 1980s. Actually, the American security, I mean, national security was supported by the Japanese money.
Yes.
You see? So this kind of the change that happened, I mean, power relationship, okay, the United States was the gigantic military superpower, and the military power could be translated into the political power. Yes, this is common sense as well. But the economic situation, the economic relationship between those countries considerably changed the nature of power, as I said, about the role of Germany. So I rather want to concentrate upon those kind of aspects. I mean, the effect of the economic relationship and sort of after effect of the economic integration, those kind of new wave. Mm. So the Cold War was pretty much about the power politics between the blocs, of course, although there are so many other kind of aspects. And I have... this is also the rough hypothesis, but I would like to prove it. The new wave of international politics could be seen, or that could be under the big structure of the Cold War developing. And that developing in new waves may have or must have changed the politics or international politics itself. And the result of that kind of the big structural or big political big change could be called the end of the Cold War.
Mm.
Rather megalomaniac, I
think. Yeah. Ambitious. Turning from the economy to more political questions, towards the start of your paper, you mentioned the doubly oppressive order that obtained during the Cold War. In other words, there was a contradiction between suppressing internal dissent and democracy, which, at least on the Western side and at least in to some extent on the Eastern side as well, was the justification for the regime and for defending the country against the other side. Mm. And as you also say, there is a general dilemma between power politics and democracy. So here we are in the post 9/11 world, yes. Post Cold War world. And what do you see as the differences between the conflict or the contradiction between internal security and democracy as it was in the Cold War and under the so-called War on Terror? Is it essentially the same conflict contradiction, or do you think it is quantitatively different now?
Hmm.
Sorry, qualitatively different now.
That's a very difficult question. During the Cold War, there was a very oppressive international or world order.
Yes.
And at the bottom of that, the third world, the citizens in the third world could be located.
Mm.
And those people were under the suppressive domestic authority, like in Philippines, the head of government were supported by their superpowers.
Yes.
And so the superpower tried to control allies. And the superpower had the strong alliance relations with their main allies, and at the same time, those bunch of allies and the superpowers were suppressing the citizens in the third world by supporting those citizens' head of government.
Yes.
This kind of the suppressive and oppressive and order existed during the Cold War. And the situation is basically unchanged in a way. I mean, still, the citizens of the third world or the fourth world, the poorest world, are under some kind of a suppression. The suppression caused by the cooperative relations that among the economically advanced countries. And I think if we try to achieve the real democracy, we need to think about those most oppressed people. But at the same time, we know that those people support the transnational terrorism, and between the quotation mark, because the terrorists are sometimes could be called the warrior for freedom.
Yes.
You see? So I think that from the viewpoint of those oppressed people, the terrorists could be the warriors for the equality, or the warriors for the freedom. Mm. So I think that if we need to cope with the insecurity of the 21st century, we cannot rely upon kind of the surgery treatment which the G.W. Bush really liked to do, or the Rumsfeld liked to do. I mean, they want to amputate the legs and the arms, and perhaps they want to chop the head off.
Are we talking about people or governments here? Sorry, I just want to...
Yes, I'm talking about in which point?
I just want to establish if this amputation that you're referring to is literal or political.
Yes, okay. GWB or those people wants to chop the head off of the people. The citizens or the oppressed people.
Right.
And at the same time, the governments supporting the terrorism, alleged to support the terrorism. So I think if we want to solve those kind of insecurity, we need to do something about those oppressed situation. And at the same time, we try to find out some good medicine which could cure the disease completely. Mm. Without an amputating anything.
Mm.
Well, otherwise, this is a kind of the story about the structural violence.
Yes.
And, without doing anything about the structure of violence, we cannot escape from that kind of insecurity. And so I think that we need to be more democratic and we need to respect the human rights and the humanity in order to establish the really secure the society.
Mm.
And, of course, you would think that we need to contain terrorists. And otherwise, we need to be always faced with the possibility or the urgent possibility of the being attacked by the terrorists. But
Darius, if I may ask you, how do you see the debate in Europe at the moment between... anti-terrorism policies and civil liberties? Is it a very lively debate in Germany, for example? I know that it is in Great Britain and Spain, but maybe how is it in countries which have not directly experienced large-scale terrorist attacks?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a good question. I wasn't aware that Britain had this kind of discussion.
From the overhang of Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. really, and possibly because it's so close to the United States.
Because we all know that the United States is now engaged in such a situation. I don't think that Germany has been in the last couple of years. I think Germany has been mostly preoccupied with domestic politics, with changes... in the welfare state structure. And this is also a question that I would like to maybe add at this point, because it's also a question about... We've just talked about the last couple of years, about the period since the end of what we've called the Cold War. And I was wondering if this end of the Cold War also meant, in a way, an end of the... welfare state system, as we had known it during the Cold War period. And Germany, for example, is going through major changes of its welfare state structure in the last years. And the Chancellor Schröder will probably lose the coming elections just because he has been identified by the public with these changes. Mm. And there's a large degree of dissatisfaction and fear of the consequences of these changes. So I'm wondering if we're now also getting, with the end of the Cold War, And maybe something like, if not an end of the welfare state, but massive changes to the welfare state. We might return to get into a new phase of international, not only economic, but also international relation and politics now. This is maybe a very broad question, but I think this is something that we might experience in the following years, and maybe we've already started to experience this. So I'm basically wondering if this is happening, what does it mean on an international scale, if we really will experience major changes to the welfare state and major changes to this internal domestic type of social organization, and we're also right now engaged in this Islam and Islamism and counterterrorism in international politics. I'm wondering how these two might relate and add to a new international situation structure.
Yeah, that's very interesting. With democracy and the transnational civic coalition is closely related, I should say. And we saw that mass demonstration on the 15th of February in 2003. That was the great transnational coalition movement of the anti-Iraq war. And I could draw a kind of theater picture that the displays the struggles or the conflicts between the governmental coalition, international governmental coalition, versus transnational civic coalition.
Yes.
And it could be said that was a very new situation, but if you trace back to the Cold War, the last decade of the Cold War, there was a very good the communication between the Western anti-nuclear movements like CND or END with the anti-regime the movements or the anti-regime leaders in the Eastern Europe.
Yes.
And those kind of the transnational and a trans-bloc coalition eroded the Cold War confrontation between two other blocs indirectly. And, of course, you know that in 1989, in the Eastern Europe, the civic movements actually pulled the last trigger of the havoc in the Eastern Europe.
Yes.
And that was a kind of the civic kind of revolution. So this kind of transnational coalition could represent a kind of the horizontalizing a trend of the world of politics, the political transformation of international relations. And that was, from my viewpoint, and inherited by the newly organized transnational coalition appealing the anti-war in Iraq. That was they got the very good weapon, the internet.
Yes.
And so they started to strengthen those transnational coalition. But this transnational coalition could be enhanced because of the democracy. The democratic, if there is no democratic society or the civil society, develop the civil society, you could not expect that the transnational coalition would be effective. And at the same time, we need to expand those kind of transnational coalition into or beyond the fault line of the civilization.
Mm.
And we need to be the more democratic if we want to expand our coalition beyond the fault line of the civilization, because we need to accept the differences. So I say the security and the democracy can just go on with it, you know, go on together. Well, we need to enhance the democracy in order to enjoy the more secure society.
Thank you. Well, on that slightly positive note, I'd like to finish the discussion. And thank you once again to Takahiko Tanaka, who I forgot to mention is Professor of Law at Hitotsubashi University. And you can read his paper, International Relations in the Formation of Cold War Structure, on the Center for New European Research website. Also, many thanks to Darius Sifunin for coming along and discussing the article with us. Thank you. Goodbye.